The World Mind's Method of Human Attraction, and hence of Human Development, the mysterious therapy of its holy grace, involves the use of suffering as one of its features. If the hand of man is responsible for so much of his own or another's misery, the hand of God must be ultimately responsible for all of it. For the divine wisdom has ordained the laws which in turn ordain that man shall pass through the realm of affliction before peace rests on his face. We may get the meaning of suffering only when we get a whole picture of it, of the bright and the dark parts, both. Some, like Mary Baker Eddy, rightly perceiving its irrelevance on the highest plane, wrongly deny it any proper place anywhere at all in the divine idea. Others, like Charles Robert Darwin, persist in looking at the shaded part of the picture only and remember the earth for its savage beasts and biological struggles, not for the food it thoughtfully gives them or the flowers it generously provides them. Both see it in a limited perspective. Still others, who persist in talking of nature's cruelty to man, ought to ask themselves whether it has ever been equal to man's cruelty to man. If there is too much cruelty in nature's arrangements for man to approve of them fully, let him consider that perhaps there was no other way to make them if nature's goals were to be achieved. If his heart continues to protest, let his head nevertheless bow down, knowing that it is in the presence of a wisdom which is unutterably infinite. If the governing laws of this universe were not beneficent, there would be no hope for mankind. But, on the contrary, there is every ground for ultimate hope. It needs remembering that the evils and pains of life have only a passing existence and are relative to the good and joys of life. Their own existence is in the end controlled by the divine laws and used for the divinely based universal outworking. Such complementaries and relativities follow by necessity as soon as this outworking itself begins afresh with every renewed cosmic period. How could any universe come into existence without both good and evil, light and darkness, joy and sorrow, coming with it? Such duality is the unescapable and tragic side of its manifestation. The existence of the one opposite is a necessary consequence of the existence of the other. Those who ask for a painless world do not comprehend that they are also asking for a joyless one. The ebb and flow between the opposites of joy and anguish, possession and loss, gives man a sense of values which he could not gain to such a vivid degree in any other way. Experience of one kind provides a needed balance for the experience of its contrary. This helps him to form a just estimate of bodily life and earthly values, a truer perception of its transiency, and thus brings him closer to the consciousness of spiritual life. To refuse a place for suffering in the divine plan when we judge it solely by our finite human feelings, is to detract from our evaluation of the divine wisdom. We see the part only and lament the evil and pain that darken it. There is no place for these ugly shadows in the sublime over-self, they belong only to the world of appearances. Here they tragically exist, there they could not even exist. This is the paradoxical situation. They cannot be denied, as some dreamers deny them, but the reality behind them, the original power behind the universe itself, is good in the highest sense. Could we but see the whole, we would discover that the beneficent and the beatific have never been dethroned. Unenlightened man hears the world's agony alone, whereas philosophic man hears both the agony and the melody hidden behind it. Pain and sorrow do not represent the whole truth of life. The pain is an everlasting bliss temporarily lost. The sorrow is an eternal peace momentarily obscured. Love will one day soothe the human tumult, light will flood the world's darkness. There is an infinite wisdom inherent in the cosmic idea which the tumult and darkness may momentarily hide from our perceptions but which they can never obliterate. The world mind is the origin of life. Ours is not a dead universe but a living one, because it is a mental one. All creative movement of this wonderful cosmos is a memorial to the hidden mind whose presence called it forth. The expression of its genius is everywhere to be found. This mind being a single one, not two or three, can manifest only a single kind of intelligence. It is not higher in some places and lower in others. Everywhere, in every part of its cosmos and behind the life of every one of its creatures, this supreme, infinite and all-knowing mind is at work. and because it is infinite intelligence, it yields an infinitely intelligent world idea. There is indeed overwhelming evidence that this is so. If reason requires an orderly principle behind the operations of nature, both the mystic's intuition and the philosopher's insight find it. A man cannot expand his knowledge of the inner working of nature without expanding his reverence for the stupendous sagacity of nature at the same time. Its existence back of things hushes the mind in amazement even when the first signs are detected, and much more when the full presence is discovered. The world's evil and misery cannot possibly be exempted from its knowledge and sovereignty. When, even where he cannot understand the misery nor condone the frightfulness, a man can bring himself to accept the logic of its existence and with it accept the universe too, he will know a great peace. Is it so hard to develop this capacity of acceptance when reason shows him unerring wisdom in so much that he can understand, when intuition tells him that love resides in the inmost heart of God's rather solar, and when revelation informs him that all is ultimately for the best in what he cannot understand? Many are those who object that much suffering misses its purpose because it does not carry its lesson with it on the surface, that a punishment which is not recognized and understood as such loses its moral effect and defeats its beneficent purpose. This criticism is especially applied to the deferred consequences of acts done in earlier births, although it is a criticism which fails to remember that everyone who resents having to pay for the mistaken acts done in former lives which he knows nothing of and who therefore considers the payment unjust, will always accept without the slightest question the advantages and benefits which come from the right acts done in those same lives. The first answer is that if suffering were the only method brought to bear upon the ego for its spiritual development, the divine idea could justly be accused of being brutal rather than educative. But evolution of man's mentality and character develops in a twofold way. It works from the outside through his environment and from the inside through his heart. Hence, alongside the experience of suffering, there is also gracious instruction to explain its meaning. This is given externally by human teachers through religions and philosophies, and internally by the soul itself through direct intuitions and valid reasonings. Since adversity and pain teach only negative wisdom, the need for getting a creative understanding of life still remains. Therefore it is that some among those who have risen on the crest wave of insight, are sent back into the world or come of their own accord, or are brought from higher planets to point out to others the more positive ways and truths. Suffering by itself does not instruct man nor lead to character reformation. Its work must be complemented and completed both by enlightenment from within and enlightenment from without. In the first case, the quality of the thought and the intuition he brings to the suffering contributes towards its educative effects. In the second case, the quality of the spiritual teaching he receives and the spiritual reading he does, has the same result. His own reflection about it, or upon other men's teaching about it, brings out its lessons. Inspired prophets, teachers, sages, saints, philosophers and mystics have appeared amongst us in every century, and one part of their mission is precisely to make those lessons clear. Men do not care to heed them simply because they do not connect the impersonal statement of those lessons with their own personal lives. But it is their duty and responsibility, not the teachers, to make this connection. The fallacies in their unconscious interpretation of life's meaning will have to be pointed out to them by further painful events where there is no disposition to have them pointed out by human teachers. This leads to the second answer, which is that the very obscurity of any causal link existing between sin and suffering, or between ignorance and suffering, or between incapacity and suffering, is intentional and deliberate. For it compels the sufferer to put to himself the question, why has this come to me? In the search for a satisfying answer, he slowly unfolds his intuition and develops his intelligence. The suffering passes, but these faculties remain. This whole situation thus becomes a device to bring them out of latency and fulfills an important part of his general evolution. Suffering remains his teacher only until he is willing to accept tuition externally at the hands of prophets, seers or sages, as well as internally from right reflection and intuition. If he will not listen to any of these divine teachers, then he must listen to the disagreeable consequence of his own wrong actions or personal deficiencies. If he will not correct in himself the faults productive of intellectual mistakes and ethical misdeeds, if he refuses to learn from history and religion, from those gifted with insight or inspired with revelations, either the lesson that wrongdoing does not pay or the need of developing what he lacks, and if he is not capable of learning in any other way, then life has no other recourse than to teach it to him through personal anguish or ignominious humiliation. It is deeply significant that the cross, which is the emblem of sorrow and pain, is in fact also the emblem of salvation. Every man is here on earth to become conscious of his superiorly self. Until he does accomplish this task, he will be led through varied experiences in many births, experiences that will be punctuated at times with pain, grief and disappointment but tinged at intervals with joy, pleasure and satisfaction to make life bearable. He will certainly accomplish it despite all lapses and all setbacks because the eternal law, the living principle of his own being, will force him to do so. He will be made to embark consciously on it in the end because he will discover it to be the only way to desirable happiness. The divine over-self does not pursue him in the sense that an ardent lover pursues the beloved one. But neither does it remain aloof and indifferent. It sits serenely in the heart waiting to welcome his return, knowing well that its power of magnetic attraction will draw him, as his own evolving spiritual values will lead him to seek it, and that instruction and suffering will finally make him aware of its presence. Such patience is immeasurable just because the love is immeasurable. The divine love is limited only by his openness to it, and his receptivity of it. And because it is an incredibly patient love, it will not and does not compel him to turn away from his servitude to earthly attractions, which turning is the first form that such openness or receptivity must take. A salvation into which he was forced, in which his free will had no part to play and with which it did not cooperate, would not be true salvation. The healer of all thy difficulties is remembrance of me, said a Middle Eastern prophet. The only thing asked of every man is to turn about, change the direction of his outlook and face the over-self. Everyone is destined to come into its enlightenment. Once he has found this presence, felt this inspiration, surrendered to this power, it will carry him serenely through whatever troubles and crises, buffetings and upheavals life may bring him. In this liberation of the self from its own desires, he will find the fulfillment of the self, the true satisfaction which those very desires are unconsciously seeking. He will come, in time, to feel that this is the high purpose for which he himself came into this world and that all other purposes have unfairly consumed more time and energy than they deserved. The human quest of happiness is too often frustrated by some hideous physical circumstance, condition, lack or defect. The human entity is driven in the end towards the non-physical, that is, towards religion, mysticism, and philosophy. And thus we arrive at their immeasurable value for man, in ascending degree, and at the important consequences of his personal worldview. For we gain from suffering, as a from travel, partly what we bring to it. Our faulty conduct of life is the natural outcome of our faulty concept of life. Without the guidance of spiritual teaching, we muddle our few opportunities, waste our precious years and misdirect our limited energies. But when we begin to shape conduct by its principles, we begin to dissolve personal disharmonies. A spiritual understanding of life, which attains its best form in philosophy, assuages the pain and lightens the struggle of life. In hours of trouble or danger, in agony of emotions or flesh, we may derive a little or much relief by letting the mind take hold of its great truths and by musing earnestly on them. But at all times they may be dwelt upon with much benefit. Their study gives significant form to the flux of life's changes that would otherwise be meaningless and goalless. Common errors concerning the surrendered life, nothing in the view presented in the foregoing pages should leave any room for indifference or callousness in the practical result, should prevent anyone from extending the hand of sympathy and help to sufferers. Nor should he deduce from them that philosophy is in quest of self-suffering, self-deprivation and self-martyrdom, If he does, he makes a grave mistake. For it never ceases to remember that if there are sorrow and pain in the movement of life, there are also grace and mercy, pardon and love at the heart of life. Nothing so far written should lead anyone to the wrong conclusion that he should cease to cultivate sympathy for those who suffer, nor should it stop the hand that goes forth to relieve distress. Those messengers from the infinite being like Jesus and Buddha could not have brought pity and taught goodness if that being itself were really cruel. If they no longer suffered in themselves, they still suffered for others. The pain was a vicarious one. But this must be noted, that their thought was not so much for people's bodies as for people's minds and hearts, and that their compassion was principally directed not towards physical sufferings, but towards mental ignorance, towards overlooked causes rather than mere effects. A true mystical philosophy does not joyfully hug the pains of life to its breast. It recognizes that although happiness is primarily an inner condition, it cannot be sundered altogether from outer conditions, that the materialism which makes light of human will and everything of human circumstances as unbalanced as the idealism which does exactly the opposite, and that if the kind of response we make to the external world is important, what the external world does to us is not less important. Nor has it much use for the attitude which insists on suffering miseries because it always accepts them as the inescapable decree of God, or for that other which waits helplessly for God to come and deliver it from its difficulties. Many Eastern and even some Western mystical leaders have rightly taught the virtue of letting God manage the universe by not attempting to interfere with his operations and the wisdom of believing that God knows better than we do how to conduct its affairs. As a direct consequence of this, they have adopted and preached to others a cult of complete social and personal indifferentism, with the wholesale resignation to all happenings as being expressions of God's will. They have taught their devotees to submit to, or acquiesce in, all events of whatever character, and to abstain from interfering with the course of events by some supposed service to mankind. Such unrestricted and unqualified counsel to submit blindly to all circumstances, because they are God's will, is sometimes judicious but sometimes dangerous. The history of religion is quite eloquent on this point. How often has selfish priestcraft, serving the interests of a discredited group or a despotic monarch, adjured suffering men and tormented women not to mend their present tribulations but to endure them unresistingly because divinely willed? How often have energies which could have been directed towards improving conditions remained unused in useless helps of pleasing God? This weak attitude was long exploited in India to claim caste to originally a sensible and flexible arrangement to as a divinely ordained rigidly unalterable institution, as it was also taken advantage of in medieval Europe where each man was supposed to be born in the place and class proper to him, above which he was not given any chance to rise. Philosophy freely admits that some circumstances, events and happenings are certainly divine leadings for us, whether pleasurable or painful, and it will be wiser in the end not to resist them. But it also says that others are devilish in origin and should certainly be resisted. Otherwise, they may lead us into error and disaster, or encourage their originators to commit further crime. Again, some events are the sweet fruit of good destiny and therefore represent opportunity which ought to be seized. But others are the bitter fruit of bad karma and therefore represent traps, snares, pitfalls or troubles which ought to be warily guarded against. The correct attitude is flexible. It is neither to assume rigidly at all times a fatalistic willingness to become the passive prey of events nor a bold determination to dominate them at all times. It is plain that nobody can hold his life entirely in his own hands. Everybody is himself held in the hands of the over-self. But the advice so often given to aspirants by religionists and mystics to yield to all events as being the actualizations of God's will, to resign unresistingly to whatever happens and whoever comes because it is ignorant egoism to do otherwise, is not accepted by philosophy unmodified as it stands. It is certainly true that there are situations when there is no other recourse for anyone except humble submission to God's will in the faith that God's wisdom is interlinked with it. It is also true that in the end God turns all circumstances, all events, towards the furtherance of the divine intention for the universe. But this does not justify everyone in blindly accepting them always as being God's immediate will. They may not be. They may be man's will. The error of those who would have us submit universally to all sorrowful and evil events because they represent the divine will, is to forget that if we submit unintelligently, uncritically and uncomprehendingly, if we do not study the meaning or lesson behind each experience, then God may send the same troubles again and again. For that which really sends us so many experiences is God's law of recompense. Our tragedies and troubles do not happen to us by chance. A divine law brings most of them as the reaction to our own unworthy thoughts, as the correlation with our own improper desires and foolish deeds, or as the consequence of our own personal imbalance. This law does not forge a cast iron fatalistic chain around us. What it does is to make a situation which, be it remembered, was created by our own previous thinking and doing, develop in a particular way if we do nothing thereafter to make it develop in an alternative way. Mere acceptance of the painful consequences of bad karma is not enough. Passive resignation to the inflexible decree of God's will is incomplete. We must add understanding to the acceptance, comprehension to the resignation. Otherwise, we suffer blindly and deprive ourselves of much of the profit which hides behind our pain. The inert acceptance by would-be religious devotees and mystics of such evil conditions as always being God's will can be characterized only as a pathetic sign of their intellectual bankruptcy. The practical result is that they regard sitting down and doing nothing, that is, idly waiting for things to drop into their laps, as the highest kind of human conduct. The dangers which beset such a passive attitude are serious. Not least is the danger of abandoning their life to mere chance and their will to mere circumstance. The extremist advocates of non-resistance ignore the evolutionary need of cultivating both intelligence and will. The way in which we meet external situations and worldly events depends on these two factors as well as on our moral status. A total acceptance of, and passive resignation to, each situation or event because we believe that God's decree is expressed by it, deprives us of the chance to develop intelligence and exercise will. But such an activity is part of the divine evolutionary idea for humanity. Blind acceptance of every event, apathetic submission in the face of every situation, and pious yielding to remediable evil really means failure to cooperate with this idea, which is the very opposite of what their advocates intend. When the celebrated Sufi mystic, Al-Hallaj, was visited by Ibrahim Khawaz, he asked his visitor, "O Ibrahim, during these 40 years of your connection with mysticism, what have you gained from it?" Ibrahim answered, "I have made the doctrine of passively trusting God to provide for all my material needs, especially my own." Al-Hallaj retorted, "You have wasted your life. A proper use of intelligence may save us from falling into grievous blunders. For a merely mechanical resignation to the will of God may, on occasions, cause self-deception, abet laziness, and excuse selfishness, whereas a wise resignation is always discriminating, reflective and profound. If we have the right kind of resignation, a resignation which does not preclude intelligent self-effort, then these difficult situations will be squarely met and honestly faced. Each new experience of the human situation becomes, if intelligently analyzed and rightly met, an asset to human character, a sharpener of human intelligence. The resignation which philosophy does accept and emphatically teaches is perceptive and not blind. It does not regard God as a glorified despot and God's will as an arbitrary fiat. Accepting Plato's precept to Aristotle, "Be sure that all punishment which is inflicted upon men by God is not tyranny, but that it is correction and instruction," it uses its intelligence to discover what in its character needs such correction and what in its mentality needs such instruction. It refuses to drift fatalistically with events. It rejects the assertion that they are necessarily God's will and therefore unchangeable or not to be changed. While on the one hand it repudiates this mystical indifferentism, on the other hand philosophy repudiates the humanistic self-sufficiency exemplified in those who scorn the mystic's inward attainment. While it points out the intellectual, ethical and practical errors of mysticism, it is much more emphatic in pointing out the errors of materialism bloated into dangerous self-conceit by dramatic scientific achievements. While it counsels understanding of what lies behind the event, it teaches drawing from within the will and strength to bear what cannot be remedied. The world war and world crisis have dealt shattering blows to the once complacent beliefs that the human intellect, unaided by any higher power or diviner light, is wise enough to build a happy utopia on earth. The benumbing mystical idea of leaving everything to be done by God and the arrogant materialistic idea of doing everything by man, are both unacceptable extremes. Philosophy teaches that only in their union and consequent mutual modification does a right attitude lie. It advocates the exercise of human will to the utmost, the continuous application of human knowledge, scientific and otherwise, to the improvement of life in every direction. But, at the same time, it seeks to understand what is the divine will for us in every situation and advocates the surrender of the results of all these efforts to this higher will. It gives up all unprofitable anxiety about results and thus keeps its inner peace, but it does not give up the efforts which can make or modify those results. It points out that the problem of bringing into working harmony the teaching which bids us resign all to God and the intelligence which bids us shape life by will, can be solved only by keeping a flexible mentality. Its acceptance of the factuality of infinite intelligence permeating and ruling both cosmic events and human existence leads to a peace and contentment which may be easily misconceived to mean inertia or indifference, cowardice or enfeeblement, laziness or fatalism. These things are not part of the philosophic life. On the contrary, it calls for personal effort and inculcates personal responsibility. But it also says do not put forth that effort in any direction that would be useless because doomed to disappointment, or that would be foolish because leading to dissatisfaction. It sets limits upon desire and teaches the unwisdom of excess. The gnawing unrest of insatiable appetite destroys all peace of mind. Philosophy says we must know when to put an end to it and we must practice the self-denial necessary to do so. It takes care to point out that the wisdom of letting go and renouncing is primarily an inner one, which may or may not have outward consequences. It admits that the final step is to limit our desires, to stop following the common unthinking trend of endlessly multiplying them, but at the same time points out that this admirable simplification does not mean that we need necessarily impose discomfort upon ourselves. Such a negative attitude towards life as that proposed by extreme asceticism does not satisfy the modern man. Yet his spiritual needs are no less great, indeed are greater, than medieval man's. Is it not better that he seek something that is within his reasonable reach, something that will uplift and exalt him whilst he yet remains usefully at work in the world? He may be as comfortable and as modern as he likes, if only he will strike a balance between worldly needs and spiritual aims. Poverty is not the only gateway to purity. The better way calls for a selective synthesis of physical with spiritual, a prudent reconciliation of hitherto divergent trends. It recognizes that the real evil does not lie in the physical possessions themselves but in the mental attachment to physical possessions. It understands the importance of thoughts, that as a man thinketh in his heart, so is he. Even the leisures and luxuries of the rich are not necessarily anti-spiritual. They could be and they most often are, but they need not be. The wise man must beware of the dangers of wealth, yes. But he need not therefore fail to appreciate its values. Not all authorities on Indian mysticism, which is supposed to support the contrary view, do so. The Shiva Samhita, an ancient and respected palm leaf text, says, "Let a householder also exert himself in yoga, his wealth and conditions of life are no obstacle, if free from attachment to them he will get the signs of success." The quest of physical comfort and the wish to accumulate possessions are natural needs and not bad in themselves. Only when they are permitted to dominate the heart of man and absorb his time to disproportionate excess do they become bad. In that event, after a certain time, a compulsory re-establishment of lost equilibrium will be brought about by karmic forces. It is praiseworthy and not blameworthy for men to endeavor to improve their position in the world. The desire and search after more earthly possessions are perfectly valid. There is nothing evil in physical things themselves. Nobody should be asked to make himself unnecessarily miserable in the name of spiritual self-discipline, nor to submit to intolerable degradations in the name of spiritual resignation.